On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, crying all the time.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 30 years ago today, Elvis Presley died at Graceland, a drugged and bloated mess. 50 years ago this year, young and wild, the gyrating, electric Elvis was at the top of his game, astonishing the country. In between was a career that crossed racial lines, launched rock and roll, thrilled fans, broke hearts, and defined 20th century celebrity in America. Before Elvis, said John Lennon, there was nothing. Well, not exactly, but what about after? In the house of American culture, is Elvis still in the building? Up next on Point, where Elvis lives now. Joining me today from Nashville, Tennessee, is Brian Mansfield. He's the Nashville correspondent for USA Today and a native Southerner. He's been following country music for years and was behind a recent article on Elvis's legacy. Brian Mansfield, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Also with us from Durham, North Carolina, Mark Anthony Neal. He's a professor of African American Studies at Duke University. He's been thinking about the intersection of Elvis and black music. That's a big intersection. He's the author of numerous books, What the Music Said, Black Popular Music and Black Public Culture, and Songs in the Key of Black Life, A Rhythm and Blues Nation. Mark Anthony Neal, thank you very much for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
And joining us from Essex, Massachusetts, Jay Sweet. He's editor-at-large of the music, film, and culture magazine Paste. Jay, good to have you with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Okay, a lot to dive into here. Wow, Brian, you've been watching sort of all the hubba-hubba around the 30th. I mean, we had the 10th and the 25th, and now the 30th. It goes on, but it's an interesting intersection of, you know, 50th of his big moment in the sun in 1957 when things were great, 30th, the end, when things were not so great. You know, just in terms of what's going on, we know they lined up last night at Graceland, 75,000 strong in a heat wave there, and were there most of the night in vigil. But what's happening around this anniversary?
Well, yeah, the interesting thing to me is there's been so much that's been going on in Memphis. The tourism industry in Memphis has been hit kind of hard as sort of residual from Katrina, and this is really sort of their comeback year. So it's been a big deal in Memphis. It's been a big deal in Graceland. But it's been a little bit quieter nationally than usual, which I found really interesting.
Mark Anthony Neal, what does that leave you thinking? Is Elvis still in the building? Or is this, you know, the great big guy with all the velvet and earlier on the wiggle gone?
Well, I think the Elvis generation is aging. I mean, that's just the reality. And for a lot of young cats, you know, for a lot of young kids, I mean, Elvis, their Elvis is this fat Elvis that was caricatured that's, you know, someplace in New Jersey working in a gas station. They really don't have any connection to the Elvis of his youth, you know, the Elvis that's in everybody's mind, you know, going back to 1957. So I don't think it's surprising that national interest starts to wane, particularly, you know, as you get younger folks in news divisions and making decisions at magazines about what kind of stories to cover. As those folks are getting younger and the folks who would know about Elvis are no longer in those kinds of positions, it makes sense that the news media is not paying as much attention to the stories they would have, say, 15 years ago.
Now, Elvis fans, do not despair. I've got a big soft spot for Elvis in my heart, and we know you're still out there. We're going to hear from the president of the Elvis Fever Fan Club before we're all finished here. But Jay Sweet, how about it? I guess there's a musical question and a cultural question. Is Elvis present in either, in the sort of happening scene in American culture, pop music today?
Yeah, I think culturally, I think everything stems from Elvis. He's one of the touchstones. I think that any cultural, someone who's trying to reach the cultural paradigm in which we live in is it will go back to. I think musically, you know, it's tough because Elvis was a musical omnivore. You know, he was a gospel guy, a folk guy, a rock and roll guy, and even some would say a jazz guy at times. I mean, he did ballads, he did this, he did that. So it's tough to say, hey, this is somebody recreating the Bob Dylan song sound. This is someone recreating the Beach Boys sound. You know, those are easy, you know, the Beatles. Those are easy. Musically, those are easy traces to make with these new artists that are coming out. But culturally, I mean, everything from South Park to Lilo and Stitch to, you know, he's everywhere. I mean, the new CBS show that's coming out, you know, is a takeoff on Viva Las Vegas. And, I mean, so I think there's...
He's in Viagra ads to Lisa Marie Presley's dismay with that same song behind the ad. She said she's revolted by that.
But, you know, I mean, culturally, you can't ignore Elvis. He's a phenomenon. It's quite simple.
What about the celebrity piece of it? I mean, if he's an omnivore, so it's hard to track his footprints because he was all over the place himself, what about Elvis as a model for, you know, contemporary celebrity, the meltdown Elvis in part?
The meltdown part? I think that we wouldn't have the Justin Timberlake style, I mean, the Michael Jackson in his heyday, the Madonna, the big spectacle without that, the latter half Elvis.
How about the Britney Spears?
Exactly. To mask a bad voice, there I said it, to mask a bad singing voice, you have to have lots of lights and dry ice and lots of explosions and hundreds of dancers and huge stage and...
Wait a minute. Are you saying Elvis had a bad singing voice? The man brings me to tears.
I'm going to say this. I'm going to say that which Elvis? I think of Elvis as a Janus, where there is the two-faced. Which one do you want to talk about?
Well, the late one I don't have much taste for, but the earlier one still
the earlier
really...
ones, of course, is incredible. I mean, you know, that's the one that turned on everyone from Bob Dylan to Rod Stewart to Mick Jagger. I mean, they will all talk about, you know, even that 68 Live special, they'll all talk about that as something that was very important to them. I mean, but, you know, I don't know how many people are saying, hey, you know, that Live from Hawaii concert really made me, you know, want to go out and be a musician.
You know, Brian Mansfield, looking here for the footprints, some of them are still awfully big. I mean, Elvis Presley Enterprises, now owned by this huge company, CKX Inc., publicly traded company. It also owns Muhammad Ali's images, and it owns the American Idol television show, all versions worldwide. That's how Celine Dion came to do a duet with Elvis on that, If I Can Dream on American Idol. That looks like a pretty big footprint, American Idol.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, you got to remember, Elvis created the American notion of celebrity. I mean, there was no bigger celebrity than Elvis, and he really didn't have a model to go on. But now, anybody that looks at that, you know, you either want to be like Elvis or you want to make sure that you avoid the mistakes that he made. I mean, I hate to say it kind of this way, but he was that original American Idol. And, it's not really a surprise to me that that's maybe where he is still the most visible on that show.
Yeah, as a kind of prototype. Mark Anthony Neal, you know, there's an interest, all kinds of interesting issues around Elvis, but racial issues very interesting because of where his music came from, which he freely acknowledged. He didn't like the title King of Rock and Roll. He said, you know, look at Fats Domino. I can't sing like him. Look at a lot of other guys. Yeah. But I wonder, you're sitting there in North Carolina. I mean, Elvis is a funny thing because on the one hand, he brought black music into the American mainstream or helped do that. On the other hand, he became, in a way, a kind of symbol of, I don't know, a certain kind of white resistance to integration. So,
well, I think in many ways, you know, Elvis is unfairly judged here. I mean, when you're listening to him singing That's All Right, or you're listening to him sing Hound Dog, you know, these are songs that he sang because this was music that he appreciated. These were artists that he was covering that he listened to.
And grew up with in Tupelo and Memphis.
Exactly. And very different from record company execs who are looking at a Georgia Gibbs, for instance, and trying to find the right vehicle for her and go to the quote-unquote race charts. And why don't we have Georgia do a Ruth Brown song? I mean, that's very different. I think very often...
Because it was organic. Because he grew up in the midst of this.
Elvis gets implicated in those nefarious practices unfairly. And then, of course, there's that huge mythology around Elvis being a myth. You know, Peter Guralnik is probably done the most important work around, you know, basically saying that, you know, Elvis wasn't a racist. You know, the famous quote about all they can do, black folks can do, is shine my shoes and, you know, Obama records and shine my shoes. I mean, it's something that was part of the mythology surrounding Elvis Presley, because I think there were many folks who were uncomfortable about the idea of this white artist from the South who very comfortably embraced forms of black musical idioms, you know, gospel and rhythm and blues, et cetera, et cetera. You know, so the logic goes, well, you know, if he's going to be successful with that, you know, obviously it must be because he must have some sort of racist, you know, desire in the context of this. But I think, you know, what makes it even more complicated here is that, you know, there's no question that let me put it this way. If Elvis Presley was black, we would not be having this conversation right now.
Uh, Why? Because we don't talk about Little Richard as much as we do about Elvis?
And because I think so much about Elvis's success, you know, besides the music, was about this sort of investment, you know, in what he represented, particularly around the idea of white masculinity. You know, he basically created an open public forum for white masculinity to be sexual in ways that we hadn't seen before. You know, when he goes on Ed Sullivan that third time, they choose to censor him, right? Did he don't want to see his
waist
swiveling
up,
hips.
Please, yeah.
Exactly. You know, so I think there's a very important investment in Elvis Presley because of who he represented to white America within that context. Now, I, you know, obviously Little Richard and Chuck Berry were never going to be as big as Elvis Presley, but the only reason why Little Richard and Chuck Berry could cross over to white audiences was because Elvis Presley popularized that sound in the first place.
We're talking about Elvis, 30 years after his death, 50 years after his peak, and what he means now. 1977, of course, his death. 1957, well, he was huge. And at the end of the year, drafted into the Army. March 7th, 1960, at a press conference in Memphis, Tennessee, right after returning from his time in the Army, Elvis was asked by a reporter whether or not he'd found love overseas.
How about any romance? Did you leave any heart, shall we say, in Germany?
Not any special one. There was a little girl that I was seeing quite often over there that her father was in the Air Force, and actually they only got over there about 2 months before I left. I was seeing her, and she was at the train at the airport when I left, and there were some pictures made of her, but it was no big romance. I mean, the stories came out the girl he left behind and all that. It wasn't like that. I mean. I had to be careful when I answer a question.
Elvis, 1960, no big romance? We're not so sure. We've been joined from Durham, North Carolina, by Mark Anthony Neal, professor of Black popular culture in the African American Studies Department at Duke University. From Nashville, by Brian Mansfield, Nashville correspondent for USA Today. Jay Sweet is with us. He's editor-at-large at Paste Magazine. And with us right now, from Jacksonville, Florida, though she'd rather be in Memphis, where the vigil went on last night for anniversary of death, Joanne Smith. She's president of the Elvis Fever Fan Club. Joanne, thank you for being here.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So is anybody filling those blue suede shoes, or is Elvis a one and only and gone?
Well, Tom, you know, I'd rather be in Memphis than I had in Jacksonville, but I couldn't be there today, so I'm glad that you invited me on the show. I'd love to tell everybody about Elvis.
Tell us about the scene in Memphis on the anniversary of his death. You've been there many times. 75,000 people last night at Graceland.
On the night of the 15th, all the presidents line up on the drive with their candles.
That is presidents of the Elvis fan clubs in their multitude.
I'm sorry?
Presidents of Elvis fan clubs, that is.
This is the presidents line up on the driveway and hold the candles.
Mm-hmm.
And all the fans, you don't have to be a fan club member to, you know, go up the gates, through the gates and up to the grave. This is fans worldwide comes in and goes up. We pay tribute to Elvis by going up to the grave and, you know, viewing the graves of him, his parents, and his grandmother, and place flowers on the graves. And this continues throughout the night until the last fan gets to go up to the grave. And we rotate standing on the grave. This is an honor we pay to Elvis by standing honor guard throughout the night, the fan club presidents.
And Joanne, when you're standing there paying honor at that grave, what are you honoring exactly in Elvis Presley? What is it that you honor?
You're honoring the man. The tribute is to the man, to his life, to his legacy, to him as a person, as what he gave us. You know, Elvis gave his fans something that nobody else could give us. He gave us something to grow up by. We grew up. Elvis gave us a life to grow up with. That we grew up while Elvis was giving us a comfort and world. Before Elvis, we just didn't have anything. We were teenagers in a world that was confusing. We were just more or less coming out of Korea or into Korea and the war and all. And it was a confusing time for teenagers. And Elvis came along and just made it a more comforting world. He gave us an out to where we had something to look forward to. We had his music. We had a handsome, good-looking. The girls had a good-looking guy to listen to sing. you know, and the guys could imitate him. And we just had something to look forward to listen to Elvis and watch his movies and all.
Will there ever be another Joanne, or is it a one and only Elvis?
Pardon?
Will there ever be another? Is anybody filling those shoes these days for you?
There'll never be another Elvis. There'll never be another Elvis. There's a lot of imitators and a lot of tribute artists, but there'll just never be another Elvis.
Joanne Smith, president of the Elvis Fever Fan Club. If it weren't for a little touch of asthma, she'd be there in Memphis, but she joined us from Jacksonville, Florida. Joanne, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Let's take a call from Nashville. Ray, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I work as a volunteer at the Country Music Hall of Fame, giving tours to children, mostly elementary groups. I'm always dumbfounded when even first graders up, when they see a bit of a clip of Elvis dancing, they know exactly who he is. Everybody knows who Elvis is, and I'm always astounded that this artist who has been gone so long has that kind of power that even the smallest elementary children know who Elvis is, well, and they love to imitate his dance.
What is it, Ray? You work at the Country Music Hall of Fame, so you're in the presence of a lot of great ones there. What is it about the Elvis, I don't know, hook that goes in so deep and identifiably?
Well, I don't know, because other than some of the more modern artists whom they look for in the Country Music Hall of Fame, Shania Twain or Tim and Faith McGraw, they don't know any of the old-timers, but they know Elvis, and how that manages to keep going is beyond me. But every time that clip comes up, I say, who's that? And they shout in unison, it's Elvis. Now, where and how they keep up with his music or his image is amazing to me.
Ray, we love that report right there from the Country Music Hall of Fame, and thanks for calling. Brian Mansfield, how do you explain it? What makes this guy singular, so identifiable, so, Ray would say, durable in people's, you know, grasp, deep or thin, but firm on Elvis?
Yeah, I don't know. There is some mystery to that. I mean, I distinctly remember finding my dad's Elvis records when I was 8 years old, and everything changed right then. And you know, and I'm watching my 5-year-old daughter really discovering Elvis and who Elvis. But she's known the music because she watched Lilo and Stitch. One of the things may come down to marketing, because Elvis was always marketed as a brand as much as he was marketed as a musician. And that's a very modern concept, which was applied really early on by Colonel Tom Parker. And so Elvis was everywhere, whether you were a fan or not. You couldn't get away from Elvis at his peak.
Mark Anthony Neal, how would you define the Elvis brand then, if that's it, if it's a kind of a marketing miracle?
There's a certain kind of swagger associated with it. There's a certain kind of power and brashness associated with it. There's obviously a certain kind of sexiness associated with it. There's a contemporary hip-hop artist by the name of Pharoah Monch who just shot a video for a single called Body Baby, in which he's dressed up as an Elvis impersonator and sings vocals on the song, you know, the way that you would imagine an Elvis impersonator singing those vocals. And I think for, you know, someone like Pharoah Monch, again, it is this kind of commentary on what Elvis represents as an icon, right? A connection to a certain kind of swagger that allows you to negotiate the world in significant ways. I mean, you know, like the example that we just heard, you know, I was 8 years old in New York City, you know, watching the 4:30 movie when I first saw things like, you know, Roustabout and Jailhouse Rock. And I grew up in New York City listening to WCBS FM, you know, which was one of the most well-known, oldie stations in the country. You know, so I heard this music all the time. And without knowing any of the history of Elvis Presley or even his, you know, his relationship to race relations, per se, you know, it was something that was striking about the sound of his voice and the music. And for me, okay, this is a way for me to think about being cool, you know, as an 8-year-old boy in the Bronx.
Jay, take us on, though. I mean, there's more here. There's the voice, there's the music, there's the brand. But, you know, I am by no means too proud to say I've stood there in Graceland, and you know, it's first of all, it's amazing to see the mansion that looms so large in the American mind for many decades there. I mean, you know, these days it doesn't look that big, though the hill is still sweeping and impressive up to it. The pillars are there, but the museum out back, my goodness, he's beautiful in those young pictures. But what strikes me is at the grave. I mean, people really stand there, and it's something like pray. there's a kind of deification here, and there are a lot of flowers there, and I, you know, you feel that gravity. I mean, you kind of want to do it, and you heard Joanne, president of Elvis Fever Fan Club. He gave us light to grow up with, a comfort, you know, comfort in the world. I mean, these are almost religious terms that she used. Why?
Well, I agree with you. I think there is a sense of idolatry that goes on with Elvis. I think he's always walked that line between kitschy and cool. And I think what that means, what I mean by that is, you know, my grandmother loved Elvis, my mother loved Elvis, and as a kid, you know, I then loved Elvis. And I think that's it's passed down from generation to generation. And maybe it might be sacrilegious to say this, but in a way, you know, that was almost you're praying to the altar of Elvis. You know, that's a passed down from generation to generation thing. And I think, you know, look, as Leonard Bernstein once said, you know, Elvis is the greatest cultural force in the 20th century. He introduced the beat to everything, you know, whether it be music, language, clothes. He created a thing like a social revolution. I mean, he was one of those few, you know, popular people who created a force. And I think that stays with a lot of people when you have that such huge change. You know, it's harder to do in now. We don't, you know, because we can get our media through so many different things and we live in this chaotic musical, you know, landscape. Mm. I think someone like Elvis, where it was all communal, meaning you could be black and be listening to Elvis and you could be white and listening to Elvis. And
55 million watching on Ed Sullivan.
It didn't 55 matter.
That's, million.
That's the key, is it was never alienating to anybody. I mean, ask anybody who felt alienated by Elvis's music.
Brian, take us south a little bit again. You're in Nashville. I mean, there is the beat. And John Lennon said before Elvis there was nothing. Again, we know, and Mark Anthony reminds us, there was a lot. There were a lot of musicians he drew from, and he said so himself. But still, there's more than the beat here. I mean, people pray to this guy, practically. Pray. What about the deification? How do you explain it?
I don't know. When I go back to standing before that grave, and I've done that one time, mm-hmm. and I think for me the thing that really sinks in there is what a tragedy it was. You know, what a waste it was. Even as much as he did, you know, I fully expected to be, you know, to be 42 and have Elvis still around. And I think there's maybe even a little guilt associated with it, because so much of what happened to him was brought on by celebrity. And you know, and you're not famous unless somebody wants you to be. And I think that at the same time that so many people admire Elvis, they also feel a sense of responsibility for him.
What, that his fans somehow urged him over the cliff, had him eating all those peanut butter and banana fried sandwiches?
Yeah, I mean, you know, fame does weird things to people, and you know, and I think that. You know, I mean, obviously, if he hadn't been so famous, I think he would have probably lived a lot longer. And so I think there's that sort of reciprocal thing. You know, you admire him, but you want to feel some sense of responsibility, even if you never met the guy.
His doctor, in that last 8 months of that year, 30 years ago, 199 prescriptions, 10,000 doses prescribed for Elvis of amphetamines and you name it. Let's go to Nashville and Carl. Hi, Carl. You're on the air.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Pretty good. What do you see?
Well, I tell you, I can't believe I'm admitting this out loud, let alone to someone else.
Okay.
I actually love Elvis Presley movies more than I like his songs. I'm just a huge fan of his movies. And I think that the reason why this guy is still as popular as he was 20, 30, 40 years ago is that he is an American icon. He is as American as crime, apple pie, and bad politics. And I think that we see the human in him. We see the flaws, the tortured soul that he was. How old was Elvis when he died?
42. He'd be 70-something now. 72, obviously.
42 years old. I'm 37, well, 36,
mm-hmm.
and I consider myself to be a young man. And to imagine, you know, a guy that young dying because of all the things that were swirling around him is about as a tragic American story as it comes and goes.
But Carl, I have to ask you, you know, what's so compelling for you about in the movies of this kind of, you know, white guy wiggling around in an is sort of an imitation or homage to what black guys have been doing for a long, long time? I mean, why doesn't he just look silly to you?
Here's the thing. Here's the thing that, that got me about his movies. You know when it's a certain movie that's so bad that it's good?
Clam Bake.
Blue Hawaii. Yeah,
were,
yeah, okay.
Movies,
that's an all-American view.
The movies
view.
Were
yeah.
so bad that yeah. they were good,
yeah.
and they just—I mean—they're just movies that I just happen to like. I just happen to like his music, and I think me
okay.
personally, I think that the tragic story of Elvis Presley is as tragic as it gets—the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Carl,
and
we've got it. We're just going to yum it up with you there for a minute, and thank you. Let's get one more before the break from Fort Drum, New York. Latasha, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
Pretty good. What do you think?
Well, you know, like you were saying, Elvis pretty much did what black men were doing for a long time. And I think a part of his popularity was the fact that, you know, parents were telling their kids, hey, you can't listen right. to this music. This black right. music is not good. It's the devil or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, here comes this white guy doing the same thing. And their parents are like, well, maybe it's okay if he's doing it. You know, it goes back like rap music, if you think a couple, you know, years ago in the 90s when it was down with rap and parental advisories on all the rap, and then all of a sudden you find out, hey, 75% of the rap music is being sold to young white people.
So, Latasha, do you see Elvis as an artist or a ripoff artist?
I think that he is an artist, you know, because of the way that he came out, he allowed for a lot of black artists to become popular. Of course, they could not reach the levels that Elvis reached, but he did give us an opportunity. So you have to, you know, did he rip us off? Did he rip off black artists? Probably, but he also gave a lot more opportunities to people who wouldn't have had it had he not come out.
Latasha, thanks for that. Mark Anthony Neal, do you concur, sir?
I don't really think of him as a rip-off artist. I mean, I think he was just representing the music that he, you know, obviously loved. I mean, the same critique could be made of a Ray Charles in terms of exploiting gospel music.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yep,
and
yep,
of course, we
enough.
Don't think about that in a racialized context.
Mm-hmm.
But all these guys from that era are playing with sounds. I mean, they're hearing all these sounds in their head and are trying to come up with a sound that speaks to who they were as young folks and the young folks who were interested in them.
Mm-hmm. Here's Elvis Presley in a 1970 press conference at the Houston Astrodome. A reporter asked Elvis about the rise of country music, and Elvis said he thought country music was fantastic.
You see, country music was always a part of the influence on my type of music anyway. It's a combination of country music and gospel and rhythm and blues all combined. It's what it really was. As a child, I was influenced by all of that.
You consider yourself basically a country music singer, then?
I would hate to say strictly country because of the fact that I liked all different types of music when I was a child, you know. Of course, the Grand Ole Opry was the first thing I ever heard, probably. But I liked blues and I liked the gospel music, gospel quartets and all that.
Do you ever pull out any of those old records from the Sun label and listen to them at all?
They sound funny, boy. They got a lot of echo on them, man, I'll tell you.
Elvis Presley in 1970. Last night, 75,000 people showed up at Graceland for a candlelight vigil. Every last fan was allowed to proceed past Elvis's grave. The vigil lasted all night into the early morning. Here's a fan from the I Remember You, Elvis fan club. He says, Elvis, part of her daily life, she says.
Sometimes it seems like it's only yesterday he's gone, and it's been 30 years already, but I think about him every day. I talk to him every day.
Paolo's calling from Arlington Heights, Massachusetts. Paolo, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, I'm a Brazilian Elvis fan, and I love Elvis. I saw Elvis on TV when I was 6 years old with my mother. I was not even here. I was in Brazil. And I was very young when he died. I was 12 years old. I miss him so much. I never saw Elvis alive besides on TV.
Was he popular in Brazil, Paolo?
He was always very popular, and he is into today. He had a lot of fans in Brazil.
A tough line, but we've got the point, not just in Brazil, but right around the world, and that is interesting, too. Let's get another call from Seth in Fall River, Massachusetts. Seth, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
How you doing?
Pretty good. What do you know?
I don't know if I'm... I'm not really an Elvis fan, but I am fascinated by the Elvis phenomenon, and I don't think you can really understand him unless you remember or realize how wounded the South still was when he came along, you know, and how many wounds he sort of unknowingly tried to heal and bandage. I mean, he was probably the first black guy in a lot of ways that, you know, white Americans could embrace and love and admire.
Even though he was as white as snow.
Yeah, Well, he allowed whites to recognize that they loved and appreciated black people without actually having to touch them. You know what I mean? And at the same time, you know, the southern whites were still feeling downtrodden and defeated by this dominant northern culture, and Elvis stood in for them and let him succeed, you know, with the North in a way that made them proud of themselves.
Yeah, Seth, and, you're on it. You're on it.
All these sort of ancient wounds that he kind of started to bandage up, and I think he was glorified for that. But of course, no normal human being could take that.
That is that's a great piece of analysis, and we appreciate it, Seth. Even if you're not an Elvis fan, Brian Mansfield, how about? I mean, there's something interesting there. Elvis, at the same time, both crossing racial lines, but also serving as a kind of stand-up, be-proud symbol for the white South. And in some ways, later on, even to my eye, sometimes cast as a symbol of, you know, white exclusionism or even, you know, what, aggressive white pride. It's hard to span all that at one time.
And certainly white excess. I mean, you can definitely see that.
Hey, we've all got excess going on.
Yeah, I mean, and that's one of the really magical things about him, for lack of a better word, is you can trace so much of modern pop culture directly back to Elvis. But then once you get to him, he brings so much to the table in terms of the history of the South and his personal story and all of the different music that's going on. I mean, not only the country and the R&B and the gospel music, but even, like the pop singers like Dean Martin and Perry Como, and he's a big fan of that stuff, and that comes into the music as well. And it's just like everything funnels into him, and then everything funnels out of it. And it's the most amazing thing.
Mark Anthony Neal, there's a great piece by a Martha Bayless in the Weekly Standard, and she writes about how provocative Elvis was in the South, where white men, there was a long tradition, we all know it, of sort of sliding over to black women when they had the chance. But white women, you know, that was a line they could not cross to black men. But here's Elvis sort of with a black demeanor, and white women in the South went wild, and it made white men mad. There was violence at his early Southern performances. That is one fascinating stew.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, you understand why that is. I mean, given the way that black masculinity, particularly as a sexualized concept, had been fashioned in the South, you know, it's something to fear. And here Elvis is embracing it. I mean, this all gets written into, you know, the whole Ed Sullivan appearance in 1957, his third appearance, you know, with the thing, you know, where they just showing him from the head up. And I think, you know, what's interesting about it, even though when you look back at Elvis, there's nothing incredibly suggestive about his sexuality and his performance.
Not by today's standards, no.
By today's standards, very tame. Right, but if you look at kind of the lineage of folks who come after him, in some ways you can't imagine Mick Jagger or Jim Morrison or Marvin Gaye circa 1973, Let's Get It On, you know, even thinking about Kurt Cobain within the context of this lineage, or R&B artists like D'Angelo, who takes off his shirt for the video for Untitled. I mean, that can all be directly traced back to Elvis, this idea of a popular male musical icon who was so highly sexualized, right, and valued because they was that Robert Plant, you can write into that lineage also. That and it didn't, in some ways, when you think about the Elvis of 1973 per se, you know, it didn't matter, you know, whether or not it was the young Elvis or the old, even the fat Elvis in some ways is highly sexualized for those fans of him and who were connected to him from the very beginning because of what he meant to them in terms of being able to openly express their sexuality.
Talk about wrapping it all up. I mean, highly sexualized and at the same time kind of deified, almost turned into a religious icon. This is exotic and interesting territory. Let's go to Shelburne, Vermont, and Dan. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing? And I got a different point of view from anybody else.
Oh, good. Let's hear it.
Well, yeah. I was in a reform school way back then when Elvis came on the scene. And the guys, we looked at each other, and so we said, like, what's going on, you know? I mean, here we had people like Clyde McFadden, for example, Laverne Baker, who we idolized. We thought they were the greatest, and they were the greatest. And I heard Laverne later, you know, maybe 30 years later, I don't know, saying, they stole my music. They stole my music. Presley called it nigger music. I mean, somebody said it nicer before, but he called it nigger music.
Did he really? I mean, I don't know the history. Okay.
Yes, he did. I remember it very clearly. And Laverne, sorry about that noise, Laverne came back from, I think it was Guam or something like that, and she said, they stole my whole career. These people have one shot.
Mm-hmm.
And he stole it, and he wasn't the only one.
But Elvis's shadow standing all over their shot.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Taking out not only the music, but the arrangements, you know? I wouldn't say that of Elvis. I'd say that of other people, like Pat Boone. He's this right-wing white boy who's stealing music and then shining with that music.
White shoes, white belt. The white shoes, white belt when it comes to
that's
Pat
right,
Boone, the words.
That's right. And that was a very poor imitation of the black singer.
Dan, we got it, and we appreciate it. Thanks for the observation. Let's get another. Melanie from Boston. Melanie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I thought I'd bring up something that's been alluded to only indirectly, and that is the class impact of Elvis and the class dimension. And I want to tell you a story. I grew up very poor in the North, white and poor in a factory town in Connecticut. We were so poor we didn't have a TV. But one night in March of 1956, my dad brought home a TV he got from a junkyard. Mm. When we put that TV on, what do you think the first thing we saw was? It was this guy, Elvis Presley. And my entire family fell in love with him immediately because we instantly intuited that he was poor. Mm-hmm. And we also, by the way, liked the fact that we thought he was biracial. We really thought he was probably both white and black.
How did you know he was poor? I mean, he did grow up poor, really poor. But how did you know that?
Well, you could hear it in his singing, which was so different from the white bread performers that we watched on our neighbor's TV because we didn't have one. We'd go to the neighbor's to watch television.
Mm-hmm.
But you could hear it. And then when he was interviewed, this, by the way, was not the Ed Sullivan show. It was the Tommy Dorsey show, which preceded the other shows. Mm-hmm. And he was interviewed afterwards a little bit, and you could hear from his accent that he was really poor. And so we loved him immediately for that.
You know, I was right there with you, Melanie. No TV either in my place, and not a whole lot of nickels to rub together. And I hear that class piece of it. He was standing up there proud in spite of all that.
Yes. And later on, I got a scholarship to a very elegant women's college, Smith. And I noticed that the girls at Smith did not like Elvis. And throughout my life, I've noticed that friends of mine who are working class like me still love Elvis, and the friends of mine who are middle class are much more lukewarm about him.
Wow,
so
maybe that's it.
Bring out that dimension.
I love it. I'm so glad you did. Brian Mansfield, how about it? Class and Elvis.
I think that's really interesting, and I'm trying to think of like the rich folks I know, but so many of them made their fortunes because of Elvis. That
thank you, Elvis Presley.
Yeah, it's probably a little bit different here, but I think she's definitely onto something. And the other thing that I thought that she brought up that hasn't really come into play here was she turns on her first TV, and the first thing that she sees is Elvis, and that's one of the other things that comes into play here is he hits just as television becomes the killer app.
Right.
It's finally into everybody's homes just about. And Elvis is all over the place, and he's the first one of those stars.
Sinatra gets the electric microphone amplification. Elvis gets the television. J Suite, maybe these are footprints again. If we look at hip-hop today, the class all over that. Maybe Elvis, in that sense, as a class, rise-up class guy, blazes a trail for hip-hop.
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously we can make the connection between gospel music. I mean, I think, you know, there are countless hip-hop artists that count gospel as their touchdown for what they're trying to do, and they're taking gospel to the streets. That's what you hear a lot of times. But I think it's interesting. I wanted to go back a little bit. I do think that this class thing that was brought up is interesting. But I also want to say, I think Elvis really, it's funny, because I don't think Elvis really stood for anything. He stood for everything. And what I mean by that is, he was all things to everybody. You can take the gun lobby, for example, and say, hey, when he went to Richard Nixon, you know, he's brandishing a gun, and that was, he wanted to be, you know, a law enforcement. At the same time, you know, and supposedly, you know, he was saying to Nixon, I'll help you infiltrate the hippie communities. And at the same time...
while he's loaded.
Right, but at the same time, some of, you know, nowadays in that same jam band culture type thing, you know, that there is Vegas, which is a huge concert gathering in Las Vegas that uses obviously lots of Elvis references, and it's made up of these kind of hippie type, or not hippie, but bands that, you know, very open and with their various anti-conservative stance, and it's really interesting because I think anybody, I mean, even the karate, you know, I mean, think of karate. You know,
oh, yeah, Elvis's karate fascination, Elvis and pretty soon everybody's a karate kid.
Yeah, go into a couple of dojos, you're going to see Elvis.
There's the definition of a deity. You can sort of read him any way you want. I want to get a couple more calls. We've got such great ones here. Forgive me, but Deborah, on the road between Atlanta and Columbia, South Carolina. Deborah, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Just great. What do you know?
Well, I just wanted to say that I have loved Elvis off and on. I'm in my mid-50s now, but we made fun of him when I was in college when he had to go psychedelic.
Sure.
And I think that he's an icon because he died so young.
And if he was 72 years old today...
Think if he had lived all these years. I mean, would he be Mick Jagger or would he be Michael Jackson?
Yeah, boy.
Johnny Cash.
I hope he's something else entirely, but that's something to consider. Let me get one more. Daniel from Somerville, Massachusetts. Daniel, you're on the air.
Hi there. I'm a music critic for the Boston Herald, but long before that, I was an Elvis Presley imitator at age 19.
Oh, you're the man.
And I've loved him, but I also feel that he's being overemphasized. I think his going Hollywood, his going glitz, his going to pop music in the late 50s helped usher in the anti-rock period of music. And, you know, white guys like Bill Haley, black guys like Chuck Berry had top 10 hits a year before he showed up on the charts. So I think he's kind of getting overemphasized. I think he's more a style influence today than anything else.
And where's that style show up today, Daniel?
Basically hip-hop, I would say. What with the jewelry, the bad clothing, the Memphis Mafia type thing.
From rhinestone capes to bling?
Yeah.
All right, there's the thumbs down kind of, you know, Elvis put us on the road to perdition, Mark Anthony Neal.
Well, I want to go back to a couple of things I think are really interesting. I mean, when you think about just these icons of the 20th century, and Michael Jackson really at his peak is the closest thing that we get to Elvis, right? And Michael doesn't quite get there.
Bad.
But I think the point that you make about Sinatra and the electric microphone and then Elvis and television and Michael Jackson and music videos.
Yep.
I mean, it really is music videos that allows Michael Jackson to even get close. And I could imagine that Michael Jackson, who really doesn't get credit for how he thought through becoming Michael Jackson, you know, despite the fact he's crazy now. I think he was very conscious of watching the way Elvis came to fame, using the vehicle, the visual medium, you know, as he was trying to chart that path for himself. The other thing I think is really important is this idea that as this kind of deified figure, I mean, Elvis really is an open signifier. And people can invest in the idea, the brand, the Elvis, any way that they want. And I think for a lot of folks, particularly the older guard of folks who are Elvis fans, I mean, for me, Elvis really marks the last moment of American innocence. Right? I mean, the civil rights movement hits the streets shortly thereafter. Vietnam becomes the definitive generation gap in American society. I mean, the young Elvis is a reminder before things became very, very complicated. You know, 5 or 6 years before the end of Camelot. I mean, all these things. You know, Elvis represented a much more innocent time for Americans.
Innocence shook it, and off we went. Wow, it's been great having you guys. Mark Anthony Neal at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. Mark, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. This has been great.
Jay Sweet, editor-at-large at Paste Magazine. Wonderful to have you with us. Thanks for being here.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
And Brian Mansfield at USA Today out of Nashville. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Anytime, Tom.
Off we go with Elvis, the only Elvis. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
For I can't help falling.